This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. It's true. It's true. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the fabulous Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. If you want to learn about the classes they offer, about their writers' conference, about their contests, you can check all that out at pnwa.org. So a little something different today. This is not a live broadcast. This is recorded. I got to have a conversation with Anne Enright. Lovely Anne Enright, Ireland. Anne has published 3 volumes of stories, 1 book of nonfiction, and several novels. In 2015, she was named the inaugural laureate for Irish fiction. Her novel, The Gathering, won the Man Booker Prize, and The Forgotten Waltz won the Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction. Her latest novel, which is fabulous, is Actress. Can't recommend it enough. And, well, here's our conversation. Enjoy.
All right, Anne. Well, I start all my conversations now with, how are you doing? How's it going for you?
It's going all right. It was a bit sparky for a couple of weeks. I had to pull out of an American tour, which was, you know, quite a thing, and then come back to sort out all the things that need to be sorted out and all the people who are vulnerable and all the rest of it. So like everyone else, we've just been taking it. Oh God, I hate this phrase, but we have started to take it a day at a time.
You know,
the teenagers are getting a bit of fresh air, and I think that's all that can be, you know, required.
You have some teenagers at home?
We have teenagers, yes. Yeah.
And they're living in our house. School,
in our house. Yeah. In our house. Yeah. They live with us.
And
we bore them. You know, in both senses of the word. But yes, and they're really bobbing along. They've got great bands. I'm delighted with them.
Well, you know, I have to say, I was just thinking today, I was writing a piece about 1978, which in Providence, where I grew up, Rhode Island, there was this massive blizzard that struck and caught everyone by surprise. And for a week, the whole city was shut down. No one could go to school. No one could go to work. I loved it. I was 12, going on 13. And I loved that civilization came to a stop and everyone just had to be there. And this is a more deadly time, but the piece of it is does remind asking you to get quiet, asking you to...
Yeah.
It's not so hard on a writer, quite frankly. My wife is a book writer.
If you can manage your dread for mankind, I suppose.
Right.
If you can manage your personal dread as well. I mean, I was talking to someone who says, well, you know, it'll be hard for some people to go back to work. And a very kind of freelance rage rose up in my heart. I said, oh, yeah, if you have a job to go back to, then it'll be great to take this as a zen piece of self-reflection. However, you know, there's a lot to rebuild after we're through this, you know.
Yeah. All right. Well, so let's get back, Anne. Let us go back. You've been writing a while, but, you know, I've always fascinated by the decision to, when you recognize that stories, I always think just stories are interesting to you as a thing, because not everybody's interested in stories, but most writers I know, it wakes up in them, whether they were sitting on their mother's knee hearing their first picture book or sometimes in college. When did stories become something that you were excited by?
Yeah, I have a kind of, constantly conflicted relationship with how you put words together in a shape and how you bring it all to an end and what the story is supposed to be. And, you know, that you ask a kind of journalistic question, well, what is the story? And you want the book to work on, you know, various levels. You want it, not too serious, not too this or that. But I suppose, I mean, I used to listen to a thing called Listen with Mother when I came home from school. It was a BBC radio program, and that would have been when I was 4 or 5. But before that, again, I remember poems, A.A. Milne's When We Are 4, for example. Yeah. Yeah. And then I hit Alice in Wonderland when I was maybe 5 or 6, and I never looked back.
Really?
You could, yeah.
At 5 or 6, you could make sense of it.
No, I doubt, but I was reaching for a phrase the other day about somebody. I was saying, no matter where she goes, she always ends up at her own front door. And that was straight from Alice. So that's a very ancient idea for me. And it still makes no sense. And it still explains something that you need to have explained. I loved Through the Looking Glass more than the Alice in Wonderland thing. The caterpillar didn't do it for me. I had no interest in his hookah. Everyone found that very exciting. I think because there were drugs, but at 6, who cares about drugs? It was, I was fascinated by the cards and the chess. I loved all that.
You know, before he passed away, I became friendly with Frank Delaney, who is a wonderful writer and interviewer and raconteur. And yes. I felt that part of my writing history came from simply telling my friends and family stories, like telling them, sitting down and telling a story. And he felt the same way, that, and he likened it to a sort of an Irish tradition of the oral story. The
I'm the youngest of 5 children, so my stories were never listened to, but I do remember being in a friend's house and recounting the story of my uncle's wedding, and the children in that house laughing at my story, all the things that happened. That was pretty cool, actually. I haven't really thought about that for a while or discussed it, actually.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Well, it's a thing to...
It was quite a very powerful moment.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. You're making something... Yeah.
Well, it's so fascinating, too, because as a writer, I published a book about writing that was like, look, in order to do this, you cannot think about what the reader thinks of your stuff, what they think of stuff, right, while you're doing it. But we do have a relationship with the reader, although it's at a distance.
Yeah.
Even when you're writing.
I have to tell you, there was a guy I liked who was laughing at all the bits of the wedding. That was a major triumph for me. It was, you know, but there's a lot of things that could be said about the readership. I've just been writing about the female readership, which is really interesting. There's like 80% of readers are women.
Probably, yeah.
So, and I've just been thinking about how they talk about whether characters are likable or not likable, and how it feels like being back at school, and how do you make a character likable? What is this quality of bonding? You know, is it, you know, the way they look or their attitude or, you know, their nail polish? What is the problem? I mean, I don't write likable or dislikable characters, and I mean, apart from the very, very serious performative aspects that you'll find an actress, for example, I don't necessarily try to bond with the reader in that way. I'd be more interested in doing what Lewis Carroll did a bit, to say, isn't this fun the way it fits together?
Right.
Well,
you have to amuse yourself, right? I mean, you've got to be your first audience on some level, right?
I think there might be some difference between bonding with the character and bonding with the book.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, you mean as a reader, so, bonding with a book.
A reader who wants to find something in a book, in a character, of course, they all want to identify with characters, but I'm not bringing them on a psychological journey that is going to enlighten them about themselves necessarily so much as putting together something that they might find interesting and fun, and a little bit, you know, bring other stuff a little bit further on for them as well. Somebody recently, a pal, said, I've never seen my own experience that clearly in somebody else's book. And that was lovely, that sense that people might find it enlarging. And that's close enough to anecdotal that you say, look at this. This is what happened at the wedding. And, you know, you get the recognition and the familiarity, and you're putting it in a new setting.
I'm always, when I read, I have to go through the thing with the characters. Even though I'm reading your book, I'm not a woman, I don't act anymore, but I'm living it with them. I'm having to have that experience in some, when the mom stole the cart I was there on that
court. Oh, yeah. Oh, good.
You know,
yeah.
That's just how I have to live it. And I don't think I'm unusual in that way. Even though I understand it's not me, I become of it, become as much of that character as I can when I'm reading it. I try to. And I just
sort of naturally do. I think there is something very mysterious about both writing and reading, that and the mystery isn't unrelated. That's something about boundaries that gets dissolved, how permeable they are when we believe something. So when we start believing something, something about the limits of the self dissolves, and that's sort of amazing.
It is. And I was thinking about with your work. So I really enjoyed The Actress. This was the first book of yours I've read. I do love, I don't like to get on this because I think we make too much of it, but I did like your voice very much, which is helpful. But it struck me that presents its own challenge, which is, as a reader, even though with someone like yourself, who obviously cares about her sentences, cares about the structure of them,
hugely,
the musicality of them, right?
Yeah.
But I don't think you'd want your reader stopping every sentence and going, wow, and coming out of the book, right?
No.
So it's fine balance, isn't it?
Yeah, you want the sweetness of realization or recognition as you're moving through the prose.
Right.
So it's not going to stop you. It's going to keep you moving.
Propel you. Right.
Yeah.
And so it's a fine line.
It is a fine line. I wouldn't know, though, because I'm so in it, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's good.
And so, because when I'm writing the sentence, I can see something and I want to get something very exactly. And somehow that sense of precision comes out of the thing that I'm writing already. And I was saying, yeah, no, I just have to get that. Just get that.
Quality.
And once I get it, that feeling of acquisition almost, of not acquisition, but of getting it. It's like a bit like understanding. And I hope that the reader has that similar sort of positive.
It is. And I was just talking with a client about this today, which is, when I teach or write, it's the thing, me understanding something that I didn't know I understood until I write it.
Yeah.
I didn't even value the thing I had understood until I wrote it down. And in writing it, you see it in a way, you kind of have to know it before you say it, but then when you write it, you know it differently, yeah?
Yeah, and when Catherine, young Catherine, goes on stage when she's a teenager and she has to say the words, she says it's like there's a gap in the world that the words will fill, and they will fill it exactly, and they'll be exactly right. And it's that feeling of rightness and of, yeah, I mean, it's very, very mysterious. It goes back to maybe, I don't know, Chomsky and ideas about grammar or how we structure language or how we think words into existence. But it's very pleasurable. And it's very communicable, so
yeah,
I can't see any downside.
Oh, good. Yeah. It's so nice to hear. I talk to too many writers, probably, and we all love it, but writers can complain. They are very capable of that.
Full of anxiety and fretfulness, yeah.
You know. All right, so some point you said, I don't just love stories. I want to write them down myself. I want to be like those people who are writing those books. Do you remember when that, like you said, no, I'm not just going to try to do this. I'm going to do this. This is what I want to do.
Can I say something about writers complaining all the time?
I would love you to, yes.
Which is, you only have one problem, and that is the problem on the page. Yeah. That's your problem.
And you made it up. You invited
that problem. Yeah, and it is. Yeah, it is exactly that. It is the problem that you wanted to have. You invited it in.
Yeah, you did.
Oh dear, yes, I can see how soluble it might all get, very paradoxical and full of knots. I was writing in my early 20s, I suppose. I wrote some kind of bad poetry when I was 16, and I started writing stories at school, Irish schools, you write stories.
Yep.
All the time, you come home tired, but happy at the end of a long day. But, you know, I put a bit of oomph into them, I suppose, and you'd read them out for the class now and then. You're lucky.
And I'm sure yours stood out. It's usually the case that people who want to be writers, they just bring a certain attention to it that everyone else who has to write doesn't bring the same attention to it.
I have met people who can write who don't have to write, and that's really strange to me.
Yeah.
That people who have the articulacy and the talent and even the imagination, and they say, well, why am I going to do that? It's a head wreck. I mean, it's like, because in my personal culture, and maybe in the wider Irish culture, if you can do it, what else would you do?
Right.
What else would you do? You're going to go into finance. I mean, you know, what else? But I have met people who can do it. I've also met writers who can't write, and who get there with considerable effort and deliberateness, right. You know?
Right.
So, you know, I mean, if I'm looking at a class of students and I say, well, who's going to be there in 20 years time? It's not always the one you expect. It's the really tenacious one. And yeah. It's the one who has a big want in them to write the thing.
The want will take you far.
To do it.
It will take you very far. You can learn a lot. Yeah. You can get better quickly if you really are determined about it.
Yeah, if you have the fire in your belly, I think, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know if my work stood out. I don't know. I don't know.
Who knows? Maybe not, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I did a writing MA in my mid-20s, and I think my work was distinctive enough by then, but I don't know at the early stuff.
Andre Debuse, the American novelist, I talked to Andre a lot, like him, and he said something interesting about voice, which I thought was pretty spot on, because, you know, voice is a big thing, especially in literary fiction. It's a, you know, what's your voice? And he identified voice as really a product of subject matter, not just meaning I write about families or I write about ships, but how you write about families, how you think about ships, how you think about the war, how you think about violence, whatever it is. It's not just the thing, but how you look at it. And I thought he was pretty spot on about that.
It's always a point of view. So yeah. It's almost always an opinion about the world.
Yeah, some
writers try to drain their prose of this sense of opinion.
Right.
And become, you know, more and more literal. They become sort of anti-metaphorical and all the rest of it. But I like the kind of energy that sense of individual gaze brings to the prose. I don't believe very plain writers. I read something once that when people are lying, they speak very, very simply.
Interesting.
And when people are not lying, they get, you know, they have imagery, they let themselves go a bit, they use metaphors, they use all those bad non-Puritan things. And that made a spooky sort of sense to me, actually.
Interesting. All right.
I'm against plain dealing all the time, you know, but I think I'm not against it completely.
So you won the Man Booker Prize in 2007, 2006?
Seven.
Okay. So that is, for my American listeners who don't know, it is the British, it's could be Canada, Ireland.
Yeah, it's what used to be called the Commonwealth. I think it probably still is called the Commonwealth and Ireland. And Ireland, who left the Commonwealth in a date that I will be, you know, killed if I can't remember it. But I'm gonna say.
Some time ago.
Yeah.
But that's your Pulitzer Prize. So you won that in your version of what we call the Pulitzer.
Yeah, I suppose it was at the time. Yeah, and it still is to an extent. Now there are Americans in it as well. It's quite an interesting culture to the prize.
What did that mean? Did it mean anything to you? Did it shake your world up a little bit? What was that like?
I mean, I grew up, you'd see it on the BBC News.
Wow.
And the speech would be on the BBC News.
Really?
I remember.
I can't even imagine that in America. It's unbelievable.
Well, yeah, no, Canada perhaps.
Right. Yeah, maybe, yeah.
Maybe. But, sorry, I don't want me to be joshing. But I remember when Kingsley Amis got it in 1973. Now, Kingsley Amis was Martin Amis's father. Yeah. And I was 11. And we sat around watching who was going to win the Booker. And he opened the envelope in a very old, clubbable sort of way. I said, is this tax-free? He said.
God.
But it, you know, and I mean, that was in the early days of the prize. It sort of grew and grew, and it became quite a major cultural moment then. So it was like a fantasy, I suppose. It was that fantasy, yeah.
But then fantasy becomes reality. And don't you kind of have to take that prize off its pedestal a little bit in order to make sense of your own life?
I think about maybe a decade later, I can take comfort when I have a setback. I say, well, at least I have... No, I got that one, so I don't have to worry. It's fine.
Right.
But that took at least 10 years. It was all, it was, it all seemed to happen in other people's heads.
Right. So you write about an actress in The Actress. I always find the overlap of the arts interesting. You've got a novelist in this, and she's mother's an actress. And talk to me about the decision to have an actress in the book as a mother, but still her life. What drew you to that?
Well, I had been working in and around the theatre, and my husband works in and around the theatre. And Dublin is quite a small world. Right. I know a lot about, not a lot about, I know how tough it is.
Right.
And I wanted to put that in, and I wanted to show the difference between the glamour of the performance and the very rickety nature of the backstage and of the life entire. So I'd always wanted to do something about that. I mean, the other thing that I realized almost after the fact is that Actress is full of other people's fictions, because that's what she does.
Right.
She goes from Ireland in the 40s and 50s. She's briefly in London, then on Broadway, and then Hollywood. And all the things she all the films and plays she does are kind of half crap, you know, because that's pretty much what actors do. They're doing second-rate fictions written by people who aren't them. So right. She kind of tries to write herself, actually, at one stage. She thinks if she can just get a monologue going, then she'll be, you know,
right.
the way performers do. And they try to find the right role for themselves. They try to hustle in the movie industry to get the right, you know, the right part. But there's no such thing really as the right part for Catherine O'Dell, who's the actress. Anyway, her daughter does write and is very steady in all of that.
Yeah.
In part because she's in charge, I suppose.
Yeah.
She didn't really say that, but she has the wherewithal, and also she's not out in the world. The performance is quieter and more unassuming than her mother's. The drama is sort of leached out of her books, whereas her mother had this big melodramatic existence. And I think those two aspects of story, that I like that. I like a bit of, you know, we live by plots. We go through them night after night on the streaming services or on the TV. It's plot, 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 right. plot. And then we get to kind of a quiet book and say, well, there's no plot, but it's beautiful. And so those are the two ends of the spectrum of plottedness there.
Yeah. And what you were talking about likable characters at the beginning of the conversation. I've never been interested in that.
Yeah.
Concept a little bit.
I actually wonder, is it a girl thing? Because we talk about it as if it's about the sexism in, you know, about female characters. But it may be something about what the readership is looking for.
Maybe. There's a whole, you're writing adult fiction. In the world of young adult fiction, there's a lot going on right now, which is a little nutty around the way the readership is influencing the writers in a way. And I think it's a little unhealthy. I'm going to be curious as how it works itself out.
Do you mean that their morality is limiting
their concept of morality, which I think is a little immature at this point, because a lot of people doing it are not coming, they're wanting something, but they lack sometimes the life experience to.
I couldn't possibly say. When I was 16, I gave 8 yards to a teacher for introducing the subject of sex to a John Keats poem. I mean, I really was really cross. But I'm sure that's not what's going on. But I do actually celebrate living with young people. Their kind of ardent morality is kind of interesting too.
They want more than what they've got. I see it in my son's world, and it's just all it's expressed. But I was going to say is that your characters are full people. And it seems anybody full is going to have the things that are so good and not so good. And that's just, I mean, if you're going to create a full character, they're not going to be saints, nobody, your protagonist, nobody.
Yeah, well, that's a very religious word.
it just came out.
Well, you know, somebody asked me quite recently why I don't forgive my characters. I didn't think that was my job. I don't either forgive them or condemn them.
Right.
And it's weird, because that implies that I made something that I would then have to forget. I made, you know, that gets very snarled and nutty, to use your word, very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Why would I do that? Why would I depict a saint? I have in The Green Road, which is the book before Actress, a very conscientious, very maternal type. But I think she puts a lot of her unhappiness into looking after people. She's quite cranky with it.
Yeah.
Makes her quite irritated and irritable, quite rightly. But you say, well, why is she so good? I mean, I would ask, why is she so good? I don't have a character. And the need to be good may come from some gap or problem or difficulty as much
actually,
as
actually. But Kat, but the mother, the actress, one of her descriptions of herself is that she was good as a girl.
She was good, and she says it in a kind of vaguely disappointed way, like,
yeah,
like cheated her then. Right. I was such a good child.
Right.
Said. We were all good children, weren't we?
Oh, of course. I think I would describe myself that way.
Isn't that kind of a part of the piety of childhood as well, that we love to be good? I was a marvelously good child. Nobody ever describes me as good. I do no harm, but nobody, I do very little harm. Or I do as little harm as I can manage, but nobody ever says, oh, she's so, I don't know, maybe they do. I don't know.
You're a kid. My son, my oldest son is certain he was rotten, and he could be, but he was also incredibly precocious. So he was like living, we always said he was like living with a CEO who had no company to run. And so,
He decided he was rotten, did he?
He's decided that himself in looking back, but he says, I can't wait for you to write essays about how rotten I was. And I was like, it's not going to happen.
Oh,
that is not coming. That is not coming.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting one. That's an interesting one. How do we form? I was just thinking recently about when I was in Catholic school growing up in Ireland. And all schools were Catholic, and of course it was run by nuns who were more or less themselves and not particularly any very difficult people. But one of them, but later on, they didn't do a lot of sin with us. But later, the teachers decided that they would stop talking about sin. And in the new open post-Vatican II Catholicism, they would call it a failure to love. So there were these children going for their first confession. And they had to confess a failure to love. I thought, my God, that's genius. How to get in to a child's sense of morality and to talk about a failure to love. It's very, very young, 5, 6, 7, to start talking about these kind of things.
It is.
Yeah.
I personally don't think I didn't go to church as a kid. I was raised really agnostic, like truly agnostic, because my parents came from kind of religious background, but were done with it by the time I came along, so they wouldn't speak good or bad of it. And so I was sort of left to just make up my own mind, and I never did join it. But I've always felt about religion that it really is not, that kids should kind of be left out of it. That's my personal belief. It's really for adults more than
religion. It's a low tactic to bring them in too early.
I think just leave them alone. They'll figure it out. Anyway.
They'll figure it out. Well, but there are great pleasures in being religious at any age that you wouldn't deny people either. I did love making my Holy Communion.
All right. Well, listen, I could talk to you for a long time, but I have only so much. So I have one more question for you.
Yes.
Before I let you go. And what I'd like you to do is finish the sentence. If writing, all the writing you've ever done, has taught you anything, it's taught you what?
All the writing you've ever done, it means that if you sit at the desk for 30 years, it changes you.
What is the most significant way you think it's changed you?
I think it makes you more free.
So there you go. Makes you free. I agree. I agree with Anne. I do. Well, this has been a lot of fun. But I'll be back again live next week with a writer I quite enjoy. Look forward to that. Until then, I want to thank my producer, RJ Jeffries, and thank all of you. Go out there, find something you love to do, and do it.